Hey, everybody, it's John. It is Heavy Things Lightly. Today, Dr. Dawn Muir, PhD from Cambridge and an educationist teaching kids up in Winnipeg, Canada, gives us the insight. We talk about all kinds of things, but what's it like to teach in a system that may not always be working toward something you agree with? She gives us great insight on Canada, educational system, and the breakdown of culture. Dr. Dawn today. Real quick, two things. Art of Tamada. Tickets are available. That's a weekend where we go deep dive on the art of hospitality by offering Georgian hospitality and teaching you the tools to throw the supra, the Georgian capy, all around the world. Please come check it out on the website, www.first-things.org. Second thing, all you guys, listen carefully, tell your friends. Our beloved general manager at KP Restaurant here in Greenville is stepping down. It's all good. It's a wonderful experience. He's held down the restaurant. And now we're looking for a new GM. This will be heavy on marketing and reaching out and spreading this First Things Foundation nonprofit restaurant into the world. But it's also some managerial skills. We're looking for one of you guys that love this stuff to consider coming in running our restaurant. Really, you'd be just simply one of the executives here at First Things trying to do our work by making this restaurant even better than it already is. And it's pretty hot. So we're looking for a restaurant person preferably, but we're looking for you to come and do something amazing. Make a commitment to a year or two or five or 10 to grow our restaurant into something even better than it is. That's an advertisement to our community, and I wanted to start with that. So reach out, write me, johnhears@firstthings.org, or write Daniel Paternos, Daniel, P-A-D-R-N-O-S, Daniel Paternos at firstthings.org. Consider a new job. Now, back to Heavy Things Lightly with Dr. Dawn Muir from Winnipeg. So Dawn, you know, I've been on this as an education binge or something. We had a couple classical educators on. And, you know, our little podcast is growing. And I've had a lot of footprints and stuff, including I was a speaker at a recent little CIRCE convention conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. And classical education keeps popping up. But you are going to be today speaking something about, like, Canadian public education or Canadian education in general, and then also philosophizing with me a little bit about the nature of the human experience vis-a-vis our new world education system. So I can't wait to hear your expertise on this. So first question is how do you make sense of a world right now that's very technological, as you sit with these young people and try to figure out the best way to talk to them and to, quote, educate them? How is that part of your job going right now vis-a-vis technology?
I actually embraced the technology because I came back into the teaching system after homeschooling for 15 years. So I felt like a brand new teacher. And so that would have been maybe 15 years ago. For this sort of last leg here. And I really felt like, oh, all of these possibilities are opened up. So we had a whole big drive at that time in our division to get technology in the classroom. So one of the big things you might have heard of was something called a whiteboard or a smart board, where it, you know about that. And then it's interactive. So you have a pen and then you can project all your visuals up on this big, lovely board. My divisional music person also got into my classroom, not just my desktop computer, but also a Mac, which means that I could also not only record anything that the kids were doing, but also create my own tracks for my performances and things like that. So it was nice for me as a creative person to have all that sort of stuff at my hands. So I would have to say that in terms of just presenting the product, what I'm doing, and engagement, I use a lot of the most recent technology in my classroom. But yeah, go ahead.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to interrupt your thought process. I was going to say, we've gotten to know each other through really through our conversations, through Substack, through education, through our support and understanding of symbolic world. I'm an Orthodox Christian. You're not, but you have sympathies in that world. In my world, technology is sort of default bad, but I'm not hearing that from you.
No. In terms of enhancing what's already good and engagement, and again, I find it an arena where I can be very creative once I've sort of mastered the tools. As a replacement, definitely not. And I know some people it does turn into that. But for me, I think any educator, if you have tools that can enhance what you're doing and provide engagement, great. Now, if you're talking about things like phones in the classroom, that's a whole other thing again. And we went through that whole phase of, oh, yes, we need to embrace the modern world. This is where kids are at. We need to have them not banning these phones in classrooms, but bringing them in and using them to, you know, to broaden their research skills through going online and all the rest of that. So, of course, within 5-8 years, they're now out of the classroom again because it was so clear that with these little things in their hands, the kids were not using it wisely. It reminds me a bit of Marx saying that, you know, when the world is perfect, the proletariat will all be reading philosophy and doing all these wonderful things.
Didn't happen.
Because, you know, it didn't happen. Because, I mean, it's just not human nature. Sorry. So when these, so things like phones coming in to be, you know, the latest wave and to be right on it, that was a failure. And that's just because I think it was an easy way out and people didn't think through what it was that actually engaged kids on their phones. It wasn't just the technology, it was the content. And so if you give them the technology with a particular content and then try to say, no, here's the content you should be using on this technology, they did not really buy it. Also, too, the limitations of things like research on the internet, especially for kids. I mean, there's teaching them about how do you go, you know, how much do you take in from Wikipedia? How much do you take in from sites? Do you go to the fifth site that comes up? And then how does Google work? What brings it to the top of the list? All that stuff, right? Which was unforeseen, and to be fair, was probably in the process of developing during the same time, because that stuff is all just taken off, right, over the last 10, 15 years, which is just when they were bringing those phones into schools. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So I wanted you on because of your insights. I sort of want, like, voice from the edge, like, no way, like the Canadian voice, coming in, and you're, you have a really beautiful way with words, and I think a really deep understanding of this new world, old world break. So tell us about your new world, old world self. How did you grow up and how did you become an educator? Because the story that I know is really interesting, and I think it'll form the rest of our conversation on some level before we jump back into education and philosophy.
Sure. Well, my parents are Jamaican. And they came up to Canada in the 50s for my dad to go to McGill University, which is one of our big prestigious universities up here. Yep. He became a political economist, and he, I think partly because of his interest in politics, but also partly because of his Christian sense of giving to the world, making a difference in the world, he became very involved in public administration and, I have to say, political economics. So through the Canadian International Development Association, which is a development agency, which is CEDA, he was sent or funded to go to several developing countries while we were growing up. So I had the privilege of the family going with him on these assignments. Mm. So we were in Somalia when I was 4 for 2 years, and then we were in Ethiopia where he was kind of trying to reform the civil service in Ethiopia under Haile Selassie in 67 for a year. And then I was able to go to high school in Jamaica when he went back to his home country to be special advisor to the prime minister and head of the civil service, also to try and bring in reforms there too, in the late 70s and early up to about 80. So after that too, he was a consultant for various places. So that I think really kind of informed me in terms of living in different places and sitting out on the balcony when he would be talking about behind the closed doors, what was happening in government, what you just read about in the newspapers, he'd be sitting chatting or discussing with friends or colleagues out on the veranda.
Is that
and
right?
My little 16-year-old self would be sitting there taking it all in, right? So again, talk about old world, new world. I remember coming back from Jamaica when I was 18, I guess, or 19, and being on the plane flying into Toronto and looking out onto the sea of concrete as we were driving down the 401 back to our house and thinking like, oh, cold and separate. This is a kid. This is never having read anything about it, but just remembering the sense of community that we had in Jamaica, just being everything smaller, everything more down to earth. Mm. So that was, I think, formative for me in terms of old and new, although I would never have articulated that at the time.
That way, but...
No, not at all. But now I see it. There was something about that old sense of community, which again, in you know, driving through industrial parks and suburbs, you can just feel it is quite different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after that, it sort of, I guess, significantly, lived in Cambridge, Oxford for 4 years while my husband was doing his DPhil in philosophy education, and then Cambridge University for 4 years where I was doing my doctorate in philosophy education, having actually done a music degree first and then a master's in education. So wow. That's kind of how I went there. So again, starting off as a pretty creative person in music and then into education and then becoming more sort of philosophical that way. So I'm not sure if that helps.
How does that
in terms
inform
of where I'm
you?
Coming from?
No, I wanted folks to hear how deeply dipped you are in this sort of the upper crust of educational conversation, how deeply traveled you are, and then how Canadian you sort of are as a way to inform all of these folks that like this conversation. I noticed that when people talk about education on our channel, it's just a natural, it's a deeply interesting topic for people because we've all done it. It's one reason being a teacher is such a pain in the butt, because everybody knows the classroom and they think they all know how to teach because they had one, you know, a teacher at some point. So here you are though, and you've sort of wound your way into this to me, like a unique position to talk about the big ideas. And so here's one of the big ideas is education is either captured by the culture or often leads the culture into a type of way of seeing. And how do you see it in Canada? Are the schools, and I know you're teaching younger kids, but are the schools the edge of the spear of what we might call postmodernism, or are they being informed by it? How do you see it?
I have always thought that education follows the cultural trend, although they do claim, with some justification, to be creating new minds for the next generation. Hmm. So in terms of behind the trend, I think unless it was accepted socially and politically what they wanted to do, they wouldn't be able to do it because they are funded by the government. They are funded by taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't just say, we're doing this thing that nobody wants us to do, which is why I think, so that's the first thing. But the second thing is now in particular, I think that split that we often hear about from other commentators about, it's a class, but really about the political and educated elite and everybody else. I think there's real tension now between those two groups, the upper educated elite, who I think are mostly in that what we would call woke kind of environment, like very politically progressive, very disintegrating, very dismissive of tradition, a lot of the self-loathing that goes on in that upper level. Mm-hmm. And I think, and again, they've all been educated through our universities, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about this, how it is the universities educating our teachers and then the teachers going out and educating our children, right? So in that sense, those ideas do flow down into the society. It is education leading the way for that change. Mm. However, I do think that previously it was much more the large body. There was consensus, and even as societies change, that consensus sort of remained uniform, even as it was changing slowly, mm-hmm. and therefore education followed. Now, I think with the tension between the two, where education is representing those elite views, you may have heard of Rob Henderson talking about luxury beliefs. I think he's exactly right on with that, and that those are just beliefs of the privileged or upper classes, the wealthy, beliefs that they have that give themselves social status amongst each other, but the consequences of which, if they're bad ideas, never affect them. They affect the poor.
Yeah.
All right. So they never have the consequences of their own ideas, and they're content to feel virtuous about positing these things and the status that comes with that, but not ever facing the consequences of that. That whole idea of, you know, marriage is archaic. Who needs marriage? But 80% of the upper level elite, once they leave college, they get married, while at the same time saying, oh, you know, marriage is an old fashioned thing. I think everyone should have a choice. There should be no stigma not getting married. Yet they are still getting married. And then that trickles down. And the people who need the most security and safety, particularly the women who need the most security and safety from a stable long-term relationship, are the ones who, oh, there's no stigma, we don't need to get married. But they face the consequences of the poverty that comes with single motherhood and the effects on the boys who are raised, particularly in single motherhood. So all that kind of stuff, that's a luxury belief thing. So to answer your question,
in Canada. No, this is wonderful. This is very interesting.
Okay. In Canada, I think that we are seeing education kind of trying to be the cutting edge, as it always thinks of itself as being, leading down into more and more of these, which we can talk about later, as really progressive anti-Western ideas. And then sort of, I do think that is changing the culture. Mm. But it has already been changed in a certain sense by that elite who were always predominant in the culture anyway. They are the politicians. They are the educators. They are the engine of the economics anyway, right?
Right.
So I don't know if that answers the question. I think it's sort of like this, but now you can really see it in the tension between the two, where regular people are saying, you're teaching what? You're teaching our kids what? We're supposed to, you know, agree
with. We see
with
that pushback in the States, big time.
Oh, yeah. And way more.
It sort of happens state by state, where there's more, mm-hmm. we're a little more decentralized, well, quite a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've established an interesting idea, which is that which flows down and maybe might be trendy and sort of born out of a desire for equity and equality, and it all sounds pretty, those ideas, those deep ideas that blow up tradition actually hurt the poor. I fundamentally agree with you. A lot of people made those arguments coming out. I think it was the senator from New York who was actually deeply responsible for a lot of the poverty programs. He always said, it's not Donahue. He's a famous politician and from New York in the 70s, but he said, yeah, the sins of the elite do not manifest in the culture of the elite. They manifest in the daily lives of the poor, which is a fascinating concept. And I agree with you. So here's a question. What should be the role of public education then? Could it ever be that there's wise enough people within education to understand what you just said? And so what they're trying to actually do is sort of reduce the damage. Could that be a role of public education? Could you imagine?
to reduce the damage of the political trend of the time,
yeah.
Of the social trend of the
okay. It's hopeful. It's hopeful. Let's be hopeful. It doesn't happen though, right? It's not happening.
It all depends. It all depends who's in charge and what the ruling ideology is, right? That's it, bottom line. And every century and every society will have a ruling ideology.
Yes.
And that's what will be in your education system, period. So if you're lucky enough to live under, who is it, Marcus Aurelius, you know, the philosopher king, okay, mm-hmm. you might get a good, you know, a great education. If you happen to live, well, that's all I need to say, right? So it all really depends. So let me bring you back to basics on this one. The question that really got me going at Cambridge to really think about what I wanted to write about, it's just that really, really basic question. What is education?
Yeah.
What's it for?
Perfect.
Right? Because what people don't actually, and when you ask most people, what is education? Well, it's a school and the kids go to school and they learn this and they learn that, right? They really do tend to default to say education is stuff you teach kids in a school or university, whatever it is. But you have to go back even more basic than that. You have to go back to, okay, once you say education, you say educating who? Okay, educating a person, a young person perhaps, from one thing to become, or teaching them towards something else, right? Moving them from here to there. And once you say moving from here to there, you have to have the question, well, what's so much better about there? Where and what's so much better about there? So as soon as you say moving or changing or giving somebody something, you have to say, well, you have to be going towards something better, right?
Right.
So once you bring in the word better, whether you like it or not, you've brought in the word good. What is good? What is, and once you've brought in the word good, you've brought in what is the good, the ultimate good, right? Mm-hmm. So again, what is the ultimate good that we want these young people to move towards, right? And again, there are so many versions of what that could be. Most people default to whatever is sort of, again, the ruling political ideology. But really, until you answer that question, how do you really know what you're doing and why you're doing it, right?
So in Canada, is the ultimate good, from what you can tell, in the education system there, this I'm talking about what we would call through high school. We can add college, but let's do primary and secondary education. Do you guys call it that in Winnipeg?
Yes. Yeah, we do.
Okay. So I think I would argue the American, the quintessential good as designed for and within the educational, you know, system is utility. So to be useful is the point of your 12 years through age 18. Do you think, did I get it right? Am I saying the answer right according to your construction that you just gave us about, you know, how education works? And if I got it right, is that the right answer?
Well, that's interesting too, because utility, or maybe how do you fit into the liberal political order? How do you become a good citizen? How do you, you know, that kind of thing, economically contribute. So I think, yes, although it's interesting because I was listening to one of your previous podcasts where one of your guests described sort of like public system in that way as, well, it's just purely how do you fit into the political order or the economics, sort of kind of utility in the way that you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that he was talking about educating for virtue, right, instead. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, actually, the people who are setting up the education system now, and I'm talking about the influence now of the most current political ideology, they're very much leaning back on this idea of virtue. Be a good person.
Interesting.
And who would argue with that, right? Nobody would argue that.
It's we very want old our, world. Well, it's very classical
well,
education.
Except that what defined the virtue, okay? So in
exactly.
their mind, someone who's virtuous is someone who cares about the climate or about the earth, what have you. Someone who recognizes their own
worth or
hidden
value.
Bias, Hidden biases.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah,
very nice.
Somebody who recognizes their own hidden biases, someone who is recognizes their own privilege, if it's appropriate, someone who is out there to lift up the poor. And again, who would not argue with that, except in terms of how you lift up the poor, by squashing down everybody else, right? So again, yes, there's this whole thing of like, we're going to make virtuous people, and it's so strong in the system now. I'll give you an example. I don't want to name too many. I hope it's not naming too many names. I took a whole batch of grade fours, fives, and sixes this morning to the symphony, and they have this fantastic program. They have concerts just for students, and they build a whole show with student performers and with professional actors and dancers that perform with the symphony. They give us an entire teacher's guide to go through the music beforehand so that the children are familiar with the music, building on skills and listening and all that kind of thing. Mm. Then they go to this, icing on the cake is the concert. Well, they rehashed one that they did maybe 12 years ago. And this one, they had gone back in the future and had gone through different musical stages, you know, and come up to the present. And of course, each stage was associated with a particular piece of music that they played. Well, they reframed the whole thing to be back in the day when people didn't really care about the earth. There was this fellow who was blah, 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 and he did this. And then after that, they were, and so all the way through, and then of course, they came up to Indigenous, which in Canada, you can't do anything without incorporating Indigenous values, Indigenous reconciliation, all that they are our Black Lives Matter up here. Mm-hmm. And so incorporating all of that. So again, it was very obvious, very much focal point, virtue of a very particular kind, right? And mm-hmm. a very particular content, right? So yes, I think they're bringing back virtue big time, but it's just a question of really that might be a contested view of what virtue actually is and what it accomplishes. Like, I mean, virtue only matters if it actually makes the right or a good difference in the world,
yeah.
Not just any difference, right? So then that's a whole other thing too. So again, that's something to discuss, which is not being discussed. We have a lot of grumbling and people saying, do I really have to be the person who stands up and says that to the kids, or do I have to advocate for this thing, which I'm really quite indifferent to or just sort of sympathetic to, but it's not my hill to die on. So we're getting grumbling about that from teachers, but nobody would dare stand up and say, actually,
I feel like you would.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
You have that spirit.
Yeah. So I've already been cut from one planning committee for our whole division, partly, I think, because I may have made comments to the effect of asking questions like, who does this actually benefit? Actually,
well, no. Let's do this funny question for a second. The size of our podcast protects you because maybe no one will see this.
But, right.
But what so far in this conversation, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being you're super fired, 1 being everyone at your school hears it and nothing happens to you. How does it feel so far, this conversation? Does it feel like someone might say something to you like, hey, Dawn, really, let's take it easy there. Would you get in trouble in Canada for this conversation?
Here's the thing. I think if it was my colleagues, people who teach beside me, they go, oh yeah, because I have had these kind of conversations
of course,
with my colleagues,
right.
other
that's
teachers.
Right. Yeah.
So they would say, yeah, makes sense. May not be my thing. If any one of the political leaders or the administration would say, oh, I knew it. She's a troublemaker. She's got really odd ideas, or she's a far right something, because that's always the answer, right? If you have any questions about any of this, you have to be a far right, horrible person or something. That's the sling. So I think, yes, I could get into, I would just be left off the next committee.
Right. You're just going to be.
I'll just be marked.
Slowly ostracized over time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's happening already. So.
But your Jamaican self doesn't protect you in some way against some of this stuff? I know. I'm really interested in this.
People ask that all the time. And I see it with other people all the time. Other people in my position, being a brown person who doesn't actually toe the line with the right attitudes. And that is, there's two options. One, I am so immersed in racism that I have internalized it, right? And don't realize it.
Oh.
Number two, I'm a traitor to my own race. I'm an Oreo cookie. I'm taking the white man's position or whatever it is supposed to be. So there are easily ways to diss me as a brown person for not having the current political ideology. Quite easy, because there's always some way to psychologize this, that I have been brainwashed into saying the things that I'm saying. Yeah.
Well, I've been watching you speak, and I'm appalled at how brainwashed you are.
Thank you.
You have to watch what you wish for in this world. And we do this. One is, I think we create great conversations. And one day, a whole bunch of people might start paying attention. But it's like the genie, you know, you're like, be careful, because you start wishing for stuff. What you really should wish for maybe is that when you go to bed, you wake up. That's why our Orthodox prayers are like, I'm kind of about to die, so I'm going to ask for some forgiveness, because it's the image of death. And so what if we could all just stay in that space where we just hope for the next day? Like, you know, it's one of the problems with the internet is people like me and really everybody that just puts a microphone in front of them. I think we can affect things. I think it's hilarious. I think if we just get the right amount of people to watch, it'll all change. That's not it. To me, that's a very French Revolution. That's you know, the Jacobins. That's how they thought. And I don't want to fall into that, though sometimes I think we do.
Although, on the other hand, if I could respond.
Yeah, please do.
Something is happening, John, and you're playing a little part in that. Now, I don't know if we mentioned it before in our other conversations. I've kind of come through the Peterson-Pageot pipeline. How I found your podcast, in fact, right? And then now recently, especially because a lot of the topics you've been covering is like, oh, yeah. So I think, although it's true, I'm old enough now to say, oh, I'm not going to make that mark on the world that I always thought I would. Mm-hmm. That's okay. But if you are doing that in your little circle and in your little space, you've seen it grow. You've seen since COVID how that whole, as Vander Klee likes to call it, that little corner of the internet, that whole awakening in another sense, like, oh, we're seeing it. Jonathan Pageau, like all that, those kind of people, anything connected to that, Paul Kingsnorth, Martin Shaw, you've interviewed those guys. It's happening. It is spreading and it is growing. And I think that you can feel really good that you are, if you want to call it a small part, but a part of that thing that is making a difference. Like it is growing throughout the world. I really do think that. So
I couldn't agree more. Number one. Number two is people pick up tools. So where people invent tools, other humans pick them up, whether they be glasses so they can read or a mouse pad, or picking up the tool of the internet is not really the problem. The problem is it's a different type of tool than we're mostly used to, in that it interacts with us differently than most tools. Most tools are more inert, you know what I mean? This thing has a spiritual sort of undergirding. And so I'm with you, and I have no problems. And in the end, you know, it's too complicated for us to figure out with our brains. But the spirit, you're right. The intuition is that my conscience tells me it's good. It's a good thing to have this conversation with you. It's a good thing to talk with Martin Shaw and Paul Kingsnorth, whom I love. It's a good thing. Now, weird things happen too. Fandom is a thing. It's really wild. We interview a lot of people that go work for us at First Things Foundation. And because our podcast is successful in its own way, weird conversations happening. You know, I'm sitting in I'm in this teeny little room that was going to be for my mom as she got old. And it just looks like it looks because we're trying to fake you out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
On the other hand, this thing is helping me to reach people about our work. It's helping me to find out about Canada and Canadian education. And now let's go into the next set of questions because I got a couple more for you. But I love that you said that. And I need it. And people who are on the internet staring into the screen, we need it because it's good to be reminded by human beings, even through the screen, that, you know, we're together in some level. So it's beautiful. I thank you for that. I really do. Here's another thing. Canada's known to South Carolinians, where I live, as like really evil. Like, it's not all that. It can't be. But what is it right now? What is Canada?
Well, you know, that's so interesting because, of course, I'm listening to podcasts all the time by Americans and British people. And they're saying the same things like, oh, well, you know, Canada's a write-off and Canada's just down the drain, blah, blah, blah. And being in the middle of it, I can say it is a tidal wave of this political ideology I was talking about, absolutely being submerged in this. But then that whole idea of, you know, these people, they just want to control you. These people, they just want a status. They just want all this other stuff. What I'm seeing is a whole lot of people who are really well-intentioned, who, without maybe previous, maybe after, actually, I can't even say without church, because some of these people are Christian as well. They have sensed or begin to grasp this thing that they can hold on to make a difference in the world, to give meaning and purpose to their life, and to do what seems perfectly obviously the right thing to do by raising up the poor and the dispossessed, right? Raising up the marginal, those that have been excluded through race or gender or being an immigrant, not being an insider. So this in and out thing, and people have grasped this as something to really put their energies into to make a difference in the world. Okay. Now, and again, Canadians, we can't even hardly say it anymore, but we are a very fundamentally British society up until 20 years ago, because Canada was built by the British settlers that came here. Except for those large pockets like Quebec, which were the French. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, again, we're known for being like quiet, deferential, decent. A lot of the things that people talk about the British traditionally as being, right? Mm-hmm. Moderate, all that kind of thing.
Funny.
So
I think the British are funny.
So we have this, and again, we have been now caught up in that whole wave of anti-Western, self-loathing. Everything in our past was just vicious colonialism. And I think a lot of, and again, another thing I was thinking of the other day too, is that most of us, except for the wave of immigrants, maybe who are still immigrants rather than me, first generation, most of us in North America have inherited privilege from the work of our parents, whether it's even my parents being immigrants or even five generations ago, 10 generations, we have this level of affluence that we inherited. And I think that, again, it's, again, fundamentally Christian values, right? You know, Tom Holland's Dominion, the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have this sense of, we being collectively, of guilt that we have so much, and now that we know that so many people have so little. So the combination of uninherited wealth, like just prosperity that we were born into, plus looking around at devastation, plus, how shall I put it? I think also the influx of alternative worldviews in the last 20 years, causing us to be very uncertain about what we believe, and especially, again, you know, they call it the death of Christianity, all that. So all of these factors coming in to make people feeling very guilty about the privilege they have, not really having anything to rest on spiritually, and therefore turning everything to this political
focus.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Everything becomes political. And you've heard this before, that without God, then everything becomes, there's another God. And if without church, there, it becomes political. But yeah, people right. have that need to for a larger, something larger than themselves, right?
Okay, keep going.
Okay, I was just going to say that in Canada, I think those things have all converged to have a whole, and again, mostly affluent people in positions of influence who feel the need to make up for past wrongs as a stamp of virtue and to show how much they care about those that don't have and to show that, I think of it as it's two types of people who become really woke and it's all connected to the white guilt thing. The first are the ones who feel the white guilt, like I'm white and privileged and you're not just because I was born white and that's not right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And mm-hmm. I got my privilege because my ancestors killed off your ancestors and that's not right. Okay. So there's the white guilt. And then the second group, in my opinion, is the people who say, and I'm not them. I am not one of those people. Okay, I just want you to know that I recognize my bias and I recognize my sins and I recognize all the things. So I'm not somebody who's going to be put into
repentant.
So I think it's a huge motivation and it's a virtuous motivation, but I think it is fundamentally misguided because they don't see that the policies that they have chosen to bring about this great utopia are actually not based on human nature at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, there you
and,
go.
And his, yeah.
Beautiful.
And historically flawed, very historically flawed. So, yeah.
That was such an excellent sort of overview of what's happening in Canada and here too. But what I want to really get at is you notice that it all starts with anthropology. Like we can fix our monkey selves by just being smarter monkeys. And there's like this delinquent approach where they don't dig into nature, the nature of man. The evolutionary explanation of our nature is just, it's just weak. The data about our cells and, you know, our bodies is not bad. Who doesn't like all that data about, you know, how our sinewy muscles work and why they work that way? But the actual study of nature, the actual study of things unseen is weak. And so I like what you said. I would believe in a woke set of policies if we were what they think we are. You know?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. On paper, it's perfect.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like if I am just, you know, an ambling animal that has desires and I need to satiate them and you're going to help. Like when they say you're going to have universal income, my animal self is like, universal income. That sounds great. Like I eat whenever I want to eat. Like, but I'm not that thing. As Dostoevsky says, you can give human beings every single thing they've ever wanted. And by the way, it's so true what he says, because he says, and they'll still break shit. Because they can't help it, because it's not our nature to be perfect. And all you got to do is look at royal families throughout history. They have everything they want, everything. And by the third generation, every kid's a freak. You know what I mean? The children are nuts.
You could say the same thing about dynasties. Any corporation that was built by one guy's hard work, third generation in,
cooked.
They lose it, right? It's everything. It's not just royalty. It's everybody. So now this brings me to something else that I hope gets down to the core here for you. I was just looking at this again, so I hope I get this all right because it's been a while. Petrarch was a poet, philosopher, writer, artist in the 1300s, and he was the first person to talk about the self. Previous to that, classically, it was the soul.
That's right.
So why does that matter? Well, there's this thing that Plato or Socrates refers to as psychagogia, which is the leading or drawing of the soul. Towards what, right? Well, in the ancient view, there was a cosmos. There was a unifying soul or spirit. And each one of our individual souls, the purpose of it was to be drawn out from where we are and find our place in the overall cosmos.
Wow.
So we were something, we were not, okay, so after Petrarch, and then Renaissance solidified this in educational theory, it became the self. And rumor has it that Petrarch changed that because he was looking around at all the turmoil in Europe, and he was finding it hard to just really justify this idea of the goodness, the cosmos, the, you know, God, drawing souls out. And he saw all of this around him. So he thought, well, maybe let's not look at that big picture because I don't see that working. Let's just look inward. So he turned inward and called it the self, like your individual self. And then it became that the point of the self in terms of education was to become perfected in itself. And you hear that all the time. Realize your potential, right? So instead of your essence or your soul, your mind, spirit, everything, finding its place in the larger cosmos, you're a small part of that larger thing, it is now you need to be perfected into this individual thing, right? And there's perfection to be found there if you just work on it hard enough. Well, of course, that is just fundamentally a different way of looking, like you're saying, at the human being and a human nature, right? So, yeah, I think that's maybe something to think about as well, that idea, not being self-contained and all that, that sort of after hundreds of years, what that turned into, and going back to the idea of cosmos, which is why I love the idea, and I've seen it all around too, about all the people who are trying to, in our North American society, re-enchant or rediscover the enchantment in the cosmos, which is what you're talking about too, right?
Yeah.
And then I discovered that for myself as a Protestant home church, like totally iconoclastic upbringing, right? Where it's functional, what they call is functional materialism or functional atheism, right? So saying words like angels and heaven, they were just words. And heaven was around somewhere I didn't know where, like, I don't want to think about. So that whole idea of re-enchanting the cosmos and thinking of it as cosmos rather than our new word, universe, right? That might be one way to go as well, which I think is, again, already happening. I think it's one of those things that is, like I was talking about before, people's awareness now that our flat materialism, we are at the end of that now. We can't really sustain.
I have to tell you, I was at a table at the restaurant being Tamada, and by the end of these dinners, people are sitting around. Sometimes if we're outside, we smoke a cigar or something. And there was a functional atheist there, for whatever that means. He told me that was a phrase for himself. He's like, I don't just day-to-day believe anything. But he said this, and he wasn't a dummy. He said, but the days when I could just make fun of Christians is over. People don't really let me do that, or it's just not cool anymore. And then we proceeded to make fun of, like, you know, like evangelical or like hardcore Southern Christians. But what he meant was, we were joking, but what he meant to say is now it's actually just humor and it's not actually aimed to destroy anybody. But there was a moment in culture, especially when I was coming up in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, it was meant to shut you up. It was meant to be like, you're a fool. Now it's like, I don't really sure I even know this stuff to be true anymore. Evolution might, maybe. That's kind of how he was talking. And at the table over and over with, it's a public setting, you know, I have to agree with you. It's happening where the vocabulary is changing.
Yeah. And even that period you're talking about of the new atheists, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was just chic to be really disparaging. And even the new atheists themselves, Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, it's no longer like this is trash. I mean, even Sam Harris has sort of embraced
kind of
some
Buddhist
kind of spirituality kind of thing. Right. Yeah. I think it's really true that period of vitriolic resistance to Christianity is kind of waning. And now people are saying, and it might have something to do too with, they were pulling out the roots of young people who were in churches, right? in churches and being very disillusioned with churches, especially North America. But now that I think the roots are pulled out, we have a whole new two generations of young people who've never stepped inside a church,
have
no idea what it's about. So again, they haven't been inoculated against Christianity like a lot of those people were during the new atheist time. So I think you're right. This is a new phase now where people are saying, okay, I don't have so much to hate about it anymore because I don't know anything much about it. But yeah, clearly, and that's the other thing too, the fact that the new atheist had nothing to offer as a positive vision. It was all tear down. And I think that's happening with our new political progressive ideology as well. It's tear down. But you don't hear much other than this utopia kind of thing, assuming, that's another thing too.
Let me ask you this. Is this the hardest thing? Because you know your stuff and you know you studied education, you're in it. Is this the hardest thing? For me, this was the hardest thing when we started high school, when I was teaching in the South Bronx, when I was teaching in Harlem. It's not the system. There was a New York City Board of Ed, whatever. I wrote a whole novel about that. By the way, I want everybody to read my novel. It's free, kind of, on Substack. But check it out. The hardest thing is there was a building and human beings in it. And at any given time, there were 45 or 100 teachers, or in our little school, I think we had, 18 high school teachers. The hardest thing was to not get everybody on the same page. It was get people to believe there could be a page. Relativism will destroy every school that ever has existed, because every school will default to utilitarianism. I just want these kids to graduate. Hey, we did it. And I think that period in school has actually ended too. I think in the next 20 years, schools will have to sit around and go, this is what we believe. I know every school has a mission statement, but just read those things. They're maddening. They're just word. They don't say anything. They don't say anything about the transcendent. They don't say anything about, profound, about anthropology, what's a human. They don't say anything. So that's my hardest thing for a school. What's your hardest thing for a school? The hardest thing that a schoolmaster has to do within the walls of any particular building called a school.
Well, first of all, I think that the force of this new ideology, I call it new because it's maybe, actually it's probably only about 5 to 5 years, a little bit more, maybe 10, that is subsuming the drive. And again, if you're in a school, not as the headmaster, but even as a headmaster in a school division, you are taking your orders from the higher ups. So you don't establish the ethos in your school. We hear it all the time from our principal, our admin. It's like, well, this is a policy in the division now, and we're here to implement the policy in the division.
Going
this way. Oh, absolutely. And everybody knows it. And to the point where it was said to us, this is where our division is going. We really believe in this. This is where the train is going. And if you're not on the train, you need to maybe find another track. It's that. So again, it's this whole ethos is in place. It's not school by school. It is, this is how we do it. Now, again, you'll have some differences between communities, right? But in terms of the overall ethos, like, what are we doing this for? And again, I will come back to, there is that strong sense now of, okay, we want good citizens. That's always been there too. We want good citizens.
I see. So that is the cult. That's the highest part of the cult, the good citizen thing.
Good citizen, a virtuous person, and a good citizen to save the world from where we're going now.
Of the problem is that the good citizen conversation for way too long, really post-World War II, at least in the United States, was productive citizen. They kind of went together. And it was, to me, I was rejecting that in the 90s, which is, you just mean if they get a good job, we did a good job? Maybe.
That's still there. But again, I think that whole thing of virtue is very, very high on the agenda in many, many places.
It may have taken the place of that productivity conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree, because we're now getting rid of exams. We're getting rid of standardized testing. It's all about self-esteem. It's all about feeling good about yourself and loving each other. it's so interesting because so much of this, you know, they talk about it all the time, the flower that's cut, right? We're existing on the fumes of Christianity. Yep, this is so fundamentally Christian and so hostile to Christianity at the same time. That's what I was going to say about before when you were saying like, oh, you know, there's no transcendence. Like, oh, we don't talk about transcendence because then we would have to be acknowledging something about religion. And we don't want to do that. Unless, of course, it's the indigenous religions, in which case that's okay. Those are all over our walls. Why? As they said, because these are more universal, you know, love, courage, honesty. I'm thinking,
what?
Interesting. We're doing this because it's universal, but the same words in a Christian context. Nope.
You mean like St. John, God is love, like right at the beginning? It's like insane. Yeah.
We know what that really is.
That's just the replacement of one ruling group for another. I get that.
Absolutely.
I always tell my friends who, like Uncle Seth, who comes on the show. By the way, guys, Uncle Seth, he's coming back. It's been a while. But Uncle Seth will always tell me, you guys are just mad because there's a new sheriff in town. But I always want to go, well, I'm not one of you guys in that conversation. I'm a weird Orthodox guy. But you're not wrong. I tell him he's not wrong. There's a new sheriff in town. The problem is the sheriff seems drunk, like they don't know where they're going. They seem like they're wandering around. Like, it just feels like one emotional moment to the next. That's how it feels.
True. Yeah. And the biggest problem I see is, again, because they're caught up emotionally. Where was I just reading about that? About being dominated by emotions. And again, I know we don't want to go the other end and say completely rational. We're not enlightenment junkies, you know. But that idea.
Dawn, can I call you, by the way? You're Dr. Dawn, aren't you?
I am Dr. Dawn.
Yes, you're Dr. Dawn. I've always called you Dawn. I'm such a jerk. I'm a woman hater, obviously. So
nobody calls me Dr. Dawn.
I'm
nobody.
Calling you Dr. Dawn. Dr.
Okay,
Dawn.
Okay, do it.
I just forgot what I was going to say. Literally, totally all the way. Guys, as my wife always says, you're like 2 years away from a hospital bed, buddy. I literally forgot. Don't hate me. I forgot.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. Oh, it'll come back to you. Yeah.
It will.
Oh, so what I was saying was being driven by emotional, although we're not going to go the whole rationality rules enlightenment thing.
That's right.
But being driven by this emotional, there's just so much. I just, it's such an interesting time to be alive. Maybe it always is if you're paying attention. It's probably always interesting time to be alive.
Always.
But this whole feminization of the public space, right? The whole morphing of the private and the public, where now we have all the virtues of femininity and womanhood that flourish in the private sphere now being put into the public sphere. This whole, we can't offend anybody. Everybody has to feel equally good. Equity. I don't love any one of my kids more than the other. Right? And even if they're, you know, an axe murderer, I will always love them, blah, blah, blah. That whole thing. Right? Or you know, like, Johnny, you fell off your bike. Come give me a hug. Dad says, come on, boy, get up, get going. You can do it. So that whole tension between the feminine and the masculine, the mom and the dad, and the whole feminine thing that has seeped now into culture where we're all consumed, and cancel culture. Cancel culture is a feminine version of men at war, right? Men would go out and just kill each other. Women will eliminate you from the group, right? Which is, so there's just so much going on there. There's like,
That's accurate.
Yeah.
I raised four daughters. And no one's going to tell me otherwise.
Yeah. Let's just put the women in charge. Okay. All right. And then there's so many good things that come with that. But then again, you don't know human nature. You're not paying attention that there needs to be balance, right? Go right back to Aristotle. There needs to be the balance, right? So there's that. And again, I think this new ideology, right, is very feminine that way, led emotionally, led by how you feel, how you're perceived to feel, how, you know, this microaggressions, right? It's something like that. Those kind of subtleties are very feminine things.
No,
right?
That's interesting. That's interesting.
So there's a whole of that, and how now our whole society, after working towards this for maybe 50 years or so, how it's been more captured than that with that than not. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, the whole sexual revolution, and we could talk about that too. That whole thing about freeing women to be more like men, right? that whole thing. It's just, it's just all so interesting. And then put on top of this ideology, where, you know, anyway, so I just think there's so much interesting stuff.
Let me ask you this, because you're unique. You're a unique thinker, and we're going to have you back for sure. No, I love the way you think, and your expertise is helpful for my audience. And next time we'll get really deep into sort of what you learned from the old world known as Jamaica, which isn't really the old world, but we'll talk about that differently. But not right now, but this is my question to you. You're dealing with, and well, I would argue, a whole series of big ideas that you have to fit into your person as a teacher, and you relate to kids in lots of unique ways and unique ideas. And I know that you're brilliant in the classroom, but let me ask you this: what you were brought up on spiritually is some type of Reformed theology, right? Your parents were religious, and I want to hear about it. Is that theology able to hold right now within you? So I would argue, as an Orthodox Christian, it's broken now. It's broken. Like, the Western Reformed theology is broken, and you can just look around. It's dead. How about inside of you? Is it able to hold within you? Are you still a Reformed Christian of some sort who goes to the altar of John Calvin or whatever? What are you doing with yourself? Hmm. How does it work?
True confessions of an Orthodox adjacent.
That's right. Oh, there it is. So this is it.
I am Orthodox adjacent. And again, Peterson Pajo Papa. Okay, I will just be real personal about this. 13 years ago, my husband left our family. So it was at that point where it's like, ooh, all of that. And we had a very conservative, very traditional Christian homeschooling family. And it was at that point when I said, okay, I need to really think about what I actually believe and what was true, what was rock, and what was sand, because all of this just dissolved into sand, right? So it started me on a personal journey just to think about and discover what was true and what I thought, how close that was to what was true. So it's been like 13 years, but the first 10 years in particular was a journey towards opening my mind to theology, to other ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would start with some very prominent, I would say, Protestant. Tim Keller was a lifesaver in the first 5 years. Okay. But even again, it's probably because coming from my very anti-intellectual, very material bound group, he was at least an intellectual who delved into bigger questions. So that opened things up for me. And then from there, it was to others. I started looking back at some of the older, maybe classical writers, not yet church fathers. That's sort of where I'm at now. Mm-hmm. And then again, hitting that pipeline into Jonathan Peugeot and the whole idea of re-enchanting the world. So for me, personally, I'm in the process of trying to come back to faith through another door, not a set of propositions, as Verveke would say. So just like, I believe this and I believe that, I say the words and then good. But trying to find God not in a personal emotional experience, which I am, unfortunately, I don't know if I've had, because either I've never had one. I've never heard the voice, or never had, you know, felt the vision, or I have out in the field with my dog, just breathing in the beauty and being happy to be alive. Was that God speaking? Because the atheist down the street says they felt the same thing too, right? So without their experience of God, but I heard someone said something beautiful the other day. Said, well, they were experiencing God, they just didn't recognize it.
Well,
so again,
intellectually.
Yeah.
But they did recognize it, because that's why they said, yeah, that was nice. That happened to me. They felt it. I don't like that phraseology, but they did. Mm-hmm. That's why you can even agree on it, because they felt what you felt.
Well, I don't know if they felt what I felt. They might have felt, oh, what a lovely day. And, oh, isn't the world wonderful? But whereas I might have felt, this is creation. This is God speaking to me. That's a very different feeling.
I might argue with you.
Okay.
I might say this. I know I'm not good at it. My brother's really good at it, but I'm not so good at it. Yep. I might say this. You thought it. You both felt it. But you thought a set of words that leads you to a different rational conclusion. But you both actually felt, and this is what I mean, goodness. And you both recognize it as good. Whatever came next, your explanation of it as creation and the breath of God or whatever, whatever comes next is an intellectual understanding of something more base, something more right brain. I was listening to McGilchrist recently, and I've started to worry that he's right and we really shouldn't read those books.
Which books? His books?
His books. And the reason is it's the left brain telling us about the right brain. His books are left brain. So that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, hold on a minute. It's very interesting. You know, Eugene Vodolatskin tried to write this book, Loris. And it's really the union of it's what I believe to be the Holy Spirit in the book. But it feels very right brainy. In other words, you don't understand almost anything that's going on half the time. Have you read Loris? I highly recommend it. And the reason you don't understand what's going on is because he really worked hard to stay out of an intellectual understanding of his characters. And he did that through liturgy. See, he's faithful Orthodox.
Right.
And that's what Dostoevsky was doing too. And without going on and on about that, the thing I was saying about that atheist you described as having felt goodness, at that moment, it's done. He felt what you felt. And it's good. Now, what about someone who feels the beauty of the sun and the wind and they say, this is shit. This is awful. This is evil. I don't know what that's maybe a more interesting question. What's going on there? Are they recognizing a demon? I don't know. It's very interesting. I don't think it's for this conversation.
No, it isn't. I'll just finish by saying that I think it's a really good point you're making. However, there must be that next step into the rational for there to be confession of faith, right? But I'll just leave it there. We'll talk about it more because then everybody would be a default Christian. Everybody would be saved, if you want to call it that way.
Okay, come on, we got one more. The reason I'm not trying to rush you, but I promised my guys that I would always try to stay under an hour. Otherwise, I'll be talking to you for the next 6 hours. But I do. So the saved idea.
That is another conversation.
I was telling Justin Brierley on one of my last podcasts, this English Protestant.
I saw it. Yeah.
The reason that I really think this is actually important and super relevant to conversations about culture and education and the future is because ultimately what I think people are trying to fix up right now, though they won't use this vocabulary, I'm including Pajot, Peterson, I'm talking about this whole corner of the world. I don't think they know this yet. And I'm breaking news. Andrew, put this in the beginning. I'm breaking this news. Is I don't think they're actually talking about what's happening to culture. I think they're talking about, and in retrospect, what has happened to Christianity. And what has to happen for all of this to make sense eventually is there has to be a conversation about what is a Christian. And that conversation is going to go round and round and round and round, like I was telling Brierley. Like at McDonald's, I remember when I was a little kid, I would put a quarter in this little thing and the quarter would roll. It was fun to watch it go plop into the jar that has all the money. And I don't know how Western society saves itself without having this conversation that ultimately ends in what is the church. I'm not joking about that at all. And I see all of this fighting for what is reality, what is multiplicity. And I hear all these scientific conversations moving eventually to, okay, we're all talking about the same thing, God, and then which God? And then Christians can't just say the Orthodox God, small o. They can't. It's not sufficient. Like, okay, well, Christ died for your sins. it's going to end up in that conversation. Now, it's possible the tech world takes all this over and there's some giant mega death monster that kills it all. Don't get me wrong. But I think all these conversations are preparations for the actual conversation, which is who is Christ, which demands what is the church. That's what I think.
Oh, cool. Cool. Can't wait. Because again, that's part of what I'm searching for, right? And yeah, absolutely. And I think what's nice about it too is that I don't know if you're like me, but I get all caught up in my head, right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about it. And theology, does this make sense? Does that make sense? This does not make sense. Does that mean, you know, domino effect? That's my problem, the domino effect.
Yeah, because
if you take the Jenga effect, you take this belief out, the whole thing falls down. Sorry. And I know this church holds on to this set of beliefs, this church overlaps and holds on to this set. But, you know, you can go through and take out those Jenga blocks all over the place. So I'm just at the point where I'm thinking, I need to stop with the Jenga blocks. I need to just put it into my body and just do it. And now, again, I meet with my little home church 2, sometimes 3 times a week. And we do have communion. We share, bread and wine together, all that kind of thing. And I can feel when we're in the flow, right? I can feel that. But I'm still too intellectual about it. So again, one of my interests in orthodoxy is that it is so tactile. It is so tangible. Mm-hmm. It is so just get down on your knees and say the words, praise God, just say it. And again, for me as a reformationist, I would say, Protestant, to even just say, even just to do this, like, you know, the churches that put their hands in the air and do all this, it's just like, oh, I can't do that. I can't. Whereas Orthodoxy is just like, get down on your knees, get down it, say it, and let it go through you rather than having to come up with it yourself. And that, and I'm just thinking, okay, it may be this is more true or this is more true, but it could be that this is just what I need to come back to that re-enchantment in a different way. But then it becomes very relativistic, and that's where the danger comes in, right?
But I wouldn't attack on that. I would say that there is, I mean, look, what I always tell my friends, I was taught about the risen Christ from a heretic named my mom. My mom was an Anglican. She was a Protestant and they on some level were teaching heresy. Like, there's no way around that. And so what I'm trying to say is that's the person that introduced me to the ability to even know Christ and find the church. So the idea that there wouldn't be lots of ways in play that you might and I might come to something like a higher understanding, that seems perfectly understandable to me.
Cool. Cool. You know what I mean? Have another good conversation about that. So before we go, because I know last time you asked me the question, I don't know if you're going to ask me today.
I want to hear this.
Okay, here's the question. How do I bring in all these bigger thoughts? How do I transmit that to kids? What am I bringing in my classroom that I think of the most value to children? And it totally ties in wonderfully with what we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. And that is beauty. Because, again, you could frame what you just said about, you did, the atheist out in the field. He is drawn, he is spoken to by the beauty that's there, that's drawing him to the next level, right? So we can talk about that too in terms of even ancient Greek idea of psychagogia, where you recognize the individual beauty in something. So a beautiful woman, but then to really appreciate or to recognize beautiful woman, the individual, you have to also know the category, what a beautiful woman is generally, right? Yeah. For this specific person. And then above that, there's the ultimate level of, well, what is beauty? Mm-hmm. Period. Okay. So it's always drawing it. Fractal is actually the new word for it, I guess. It's fractal because it's drawing you up through different layers that have the same structure and embedded in each other, drawing you up towards that ultimate beauty. So in my classroom, my little tag on my emails says, music education, to me, what is music education? It's discovering or sharing in the discovery. Oh, let me do it again. Sharing the joy of discovering the world of music and the world through music. Okay. So it's joy its discovery, the beauty that is in music and the beauty that is in the world through music, because I happen to be a music teacher. If I were a classroom teacher, I would bring the beauty in other ways, but it just, it's on a platter when you've got music, right? So again, it's a wonderful way. And you used to think like, oh, music teacher. In my building, I'm the person who fills in your half an hour prep time. That's it. Okay. Send the kids to me for half an hour so you can get your prep time, right? And I'm also the person who puts on those great shows, and isn't it nice that the kids sing? Until I remind people of the joy that they see in these children's faces when they're on the stage all together and they're singing their hearts out, and and they're so pleased to be sharing in the joy of having created something beautiful together that they're sharing with their parents, and their parents are beaming at them. The whole thing of community, all the work, all the hard work, all the achievement, all the excellence, all the satisfaction, all the beauty that they're able to share in that moment of joy of performing. So I try to bring that into my classroom all the time. So whenever we do a song, we are doing, oh, this song is from Mali, and this is where they were singing it. This is what the people, this is what the words mean. And here's some pictures of the people. And this is how they were sharing it. Now, again, I've been able to go under the wire of political correctness because I do a very multicultural program. So
why not? Because there's nothing wrong with many cultures.
Absolutely. So. And I'm all for not for multiculturalism. I'm all for celebrating cultures around the world.
I'm not from multiculturalism
because that's a different thing. But I am all about that, but not with that whole baggage of white guilt. So I'm all about celebrating everybody's culture. But just
this is a beautiful tome right there to a proper teaching perspective. So let's keep going because there's more to talk about. But let's cut it here, and then what we'll do is we'll keep talking. We could talk about Three Souls too. I'm going to talk to you off camera about that. But in another time, in a very near future, we'll keep talking, okay? And maybe you'll come to one of these art automatas, but I don't know. They're kind of expensive, but they help us a lot at First Things. They help us a lot. So we'll figure it out, okay? So, guys, and Dr. Remember, Dawn. Oh, so go ahead. Dawn's going to keep going, guys.
No, I was just going to say, and remember, you said you wanted to come to Winnipeg sometime. So that'd be great, too.
That's check. I'm serious. We talked about this stuff.
Yeah.
Guys, Dr. Dawn Muir, who is, I could see her coming back often. Thank you, Dawn. What good insight. And a lot of for us to learn from what you said. So, guys, Dawn, we'll see you. And everybody, we'll see you soon on Heavy Things Lightly. Okay, well, look, here's what I think. I think this woman with all this interesting heritage, teaching with these deep philosophical ideas and infusing them into her work as a teacher of the arts, I think it gives us great insight into somebody trying to do something like not forget the past while also wrestling with the benefits of the future and the benefits of the present. So postmodernism, we just watched Dawn Muir wrestle with it. Guys, www.first-things.org. Remember, our restaurant is looking for a leader, and it's awesome. I just can't do it. Otherwise, I would do it. I got to do this other stuff. Our restaurant is looking for a leader, and our nonprofit where we send people and change their lives and also affect the lives of others in a positive way. This Peace Corps style orthodox ethos type thing is also looking for field workers. And finally, we're always looking for monthly donors. People who chip in 10, 20, 30, 100 each month to say, I got your back. Because it's the internet. I don't know how the energy works on the internet, but love, right? Beauty, truth, they defy gravity. And so good things are happening. And they happen in great numbers when people offer just a little bit of what they have. And so whatever you have, consider it as a tithe. Consider however you want to do it. go to our website and jump on monthly. And we'll talk each month and we'll get inside baseball on all of these deep ideas. Guys, thank you. Heavy Things Lightly. See you next week. A lot of cool interviews coming up, including go check out a book, Orphan X. It's this interesting author is coming on soon, Greg Hurwitz. I don't know about it. This is going to be interesting. Anyway, lots more Father Turbo's coming up. I hope you guys are good. God bless. Take care.